This is the 2009 West Coast School of the Prophets. The theme for the weekend is How to Guard the Heritage of Bible Truth. Our speaker is Brother Roger Lewis. This is Session 2, Part 1, entitled Remove Not the Ancient Landmark. Brother Roger.
Well, thank you, Brother Chairman, and good morning. Deuteronomy chapter 27 is our opening passage for our opening study. This is only a brief session of 30 minutes long, but it's a session that will be helpful in, shall we say, introducing the theme and the spirit of our whole day together for this particular Friday on the subject of the heritage of the truth. So the title of this session is Remove Not the Ancient Landmark. And do you notice in Deuteronomy chapter 27, you'll remember that in that chapter we're told on verse 12, Moses charged the people the same day saying, these shall stand upon Mount Gerizim to bless the people when you come over Jordan, Simeon and Levi and Judah and Issachar and Joseph and Benjamin, and these shall stand upon Mount Ebal to curse Reuben, Gad, and Asher, and Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. And then in the next few verses, we have 12 curses that were obviously the curses enunciated upon Mount Ebal. And one of the curses, notice verse 17, one of the curses of the law was, cursed be he that removeth his neighbor's landmark, and all the people shall say Amen. So this idea of removing the landmark was so significant and so important that it became one of the great curses of the law. If you ever did this, you were adjudged to be cursed by the law. And that's the story, really, of our short opening session this morning, is the significance of this phrase about removing the landmark. Now, the word landmark here in Deuteronomy chapter 27 and verse 17, the Hebrew word gebul, actually means border or coast or landmark. It's mostly translated border. So I think that gives us the idea. And obviously what it did was it refers to territory being enclosed within a boundary. And you'll realize that even today, well, I'm not sure what happens in America, but certainly in New Zealand, and I presume over here, properties marked out by boundary pegs. Do you still have boundary pegs here? Same thing in Canada? So it's a common thing for the purpose of property rights that boundary pegs mark out the extent of a property over which a title or a property title is held. Well, it's no different to that in Israelitish times, as there was a landmark or a border that related to a property. And what the law said is, you are never, ever allowed to remove that border. Mainly a stone, a border stone. Stone was set to mark the boundary or the border of property. Now, let me give you an illustration of how this worked and how it worked so well in ancient times. If you come back to Genesis chapter 23, this is the chapter where Sarah dies and Abraham buries her. And we're told in this chapter that he went to the sons of Heth, the children of Heth, to negotiate a burial place for Sarah, his wife. Of course, one of the principles about this, or one of the lessons behind Genesis 23, is that he had to buy it. Even though the land was promised to him, he had not so much as to set his foot in it, as Stephen says in Acts 7, so much so that he had to go and buy a burial place for Sarah, where, of course, eventually he would be buried himself. Now, what's interesting about the purchase of property in biblical times is that there wasn't a title document handed over. So if you didn't have a title document to say that you were the owner and the possessor of this property, then how was it made clear that you did own it? Why were there not lots of disputes as to who owned what, or where, or when, or for how much? And the answer is that in ancient times there were two things, two principles that stood side by side that protected property rights. The first is that the transaction occurred in the gate of the city. So you'll notice in Genesis 23 it says in verse, where is it? Maybe verse 7, Abram stood up and bowed himself to the people of the land, even the children of Heth, and he communed with them, saying, "If it be your mind that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and entreat for me to Ephron the son of Zohar." And Ephron, verse 10, dwelt among the children of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abram, and notice this, he answered him in the audience of the children of Heth, even of all that went in at the gate of his city. So transactions for property and other things were transacted at the gate of the city. Who's at the gate of the city? The elders were at the gate of the city, but on this occasion, who else was at the gate of the city? And the answer is verse 13, he spake unto Ephron in the audience of the people of the land. So far from being able to negotiate the purchase in private, you went down to the gate of the city where the elders were, you brought the person down that you wanted to buy off, but anyone else was entitled to come along. And whilst we might say, well, I'm not particularly happy with everyone being privy to my transaction, in fact, it was an excellent thing. Because the more people that were there at the gate of the city, the more people could attest to the fact that you had bought that property. So it became common knowledge in the community that you were the rightful owner, because not only had they heard the matter of the transaction and the negotiation, and of course what happens on this occasion, verse 15, Ephron answered Abram saying, "My lord, hearken unto me, the land's worth 400 shekels of silver, but what is that betwixt me and thee? Bury thy dead." And Abram hearkened unto Ephron, and Abram weighed to Ephron the silver which he'd named in the audience of the sons of Heth, 400 shekels of silver, current money, with the merchant. Do you know they must have all shaken their heads that day in disappointment? See, what they were expecting was the beginning of a classic Middle Eastern negotiation. Ephron named a price that was outrageously high, ridiculously high for the land. The land's worth 400 shekels of silver. What was expected is that Abram would say, 400 shekels of silver for this miserable, pathetic piece of land that I can't even grow, you know, my favourite olives on. I wouldn't consider giving you 100 shekels of silver if that's a paltry piece of land. And then Ephron would say, "Well, my lord, you know, it's been in my family for generations. The very least I could think of is 380 shekels of silver. 380 shekels of silver. I wouldn't." And so the negotiation would go on until they reached a compromise where, you know, it's Proverbs. It is naught, says the buyer, but when he goes on his way, he rejoiceth. And they must have all shaken their heads sadly that day, because Abram handed over the money. Just like that. You see, such was his grief for the death of Sarah that Abram couldn't negotiate that day. He didn't want to bargain that day. He just paid the money. And they must have all shaken their heads to know that this man was so deeply grieving for the loss of his wife. And not only that, but he wanted to pay full price in honour of the fact that this was the piece of land in which he would bury his beloved wife. Now I want you to notice what it says, having weighed out the money. Look at this, verse 17. So what did he buy? This is a legal document. Listen, here's the legal terms, verse 17. "And the field of Ephron, which was in Machpelah, which was before Mamre, the field and the cave which was therein, and all the trees that were in the field, that were in all the borders round about, were made sure unto Abraham for a possession in the presence of the children of Heth, before all that went in at the gate of his city." Hear the legal description of the land? It's absolutely precisely described. And how would you know where the borders were? And the answer is, there were boundary stones that marked out the borders of that field that he bought. And everything that belonged to that field, everything that appertained to that field, including the cave and all the trees, all passed to Abraham by means of a purchase that was witnessed by all the audience in the gate of the city. See, it was actually a very sound basis for purchasing property. Every subsequent person would know that that land belonged to Abram. Even though he was a stranger amongst the sons of Heth, no debate that Abram owned that land. And no debate as to where the boundaries were, because the border stones were there. And if you did pick up that border stone, it would be, the gravel would be old underneath. It was as if that stone had been there for a long, long time. Everybody knew. And so that's why Genesis marks it out in this way, and why Deuteronomy says you are never, ever, ever allowed to move boundary stones. Because that's the sacred lines of that piece of territory that belongs to someone. That's the inheritance of that person. And so there was a benefit to everyone, wasn't there, in upholding that process, because not only did the children of Heth witness Abram's purchase, but by that same process of public purchase and boundary stones, their own property was just as safe, wasn't it? They depended on that same process to guard their own property, because after all, a man's property, his wealth was largely the land that he owned. And then on the land, he would have his flocks and his vineyards and his olive yards, but it all depended on the land. He needed to own the land. And that, even though he didn't have a title deed held by the owner, his possession was marked out by the knowledge of the city and the boundary stones which marked out his property. Now, we won't turn to this particular reference, but it's interesting, you'll recall this on a later occasion. A certain king wanted to buy a certain piece of land to turn it into a garden of herbs. Do you remember that? And the record says that Ahab said to Naboth, "Give me thy vineyard that I may have it for a garden of herbs, because it's near unto my house, and I will give thee a better vineyard for it." And Naboth said, 1 Kings 21 verse 3, Naboth said, "Yahweh forbid it me that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee." So the piece of land that Naboth had, his vineyard, wasn't just Naboth's. It was Naboth's dad. And it was Naboth's grandfather, and Naboth's great-grandfather, and Naboth's great-great-grandfather, who owned that same vineyard all the way back down through time. How long do you think the boundary stones had been there for Naboth's vineyard? Absolutely unmoved on that piece of land. For generation after generation, the boundary stones stayed exactly where they were, because that was a man's property. You never touch that. You don't ever move that. And that was Yahweh's inheritance. "I'm not allowed to do that," said Naboth. "God forbid that I should give the inheritance of my fathers unto thee. Not for any price," says Naboth. You see how sacred that possession was in that context.
Roger, if he would have done that, would he have brought himself under that curse?
Well, perhaps in a sense, because the principle of the law was that the inheritance needed to remain in the tribe and in the family, says Numbers chapter 36. So much so that the law pertained even to the daughters of Zelophehad, remember, is that the daughters of Zelophehad were able to inherit instead of sons. If there were no sons in a family, the inheritance passed to the daughters so that the inheritance would be kept safe and intact. So the boundary stones remained. And they remained there, obviously, for a long time. Those boundary stones were sacred, and nobody was entitled to move them. So now come back to Deuteronomy chapter 19. And so now we've got a similar passage in the law, but just another little phrase that's helpful. Deuteronomy chapter 19. Oh, and by the way, one thing I forgot to mention, back in Genesis 23, when it said in verse 17, the cave and the field and all the trees that were in all the borders round about, the word borders in Genesis 23 verse 17 is the word landmark. Same word landmark out of Deuteronomy chapter 27 verse 7. And the same word here in Deuteronomy chapter 19 and verse 14. Which says this: "Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's landmark, which they of old time have set in thine inheritance, which thou shalt inherit in the land that Yahweh thy God giveth thee to possess it." The New American Standard Bible says for verse 14, "You shall not remove your neighbor's boundary mark which the ancestors have set." You shall not remove your neighbor's boundary mark which the ancestors have set. The New International Version says, "Thou shalt not remove thy neighbor's boundary stone." That stone was set by your ancestors. It's never to be moved. It's sacred, the placing of that stone. It marks out the boundary. Now, you can see why this is so important, because you see, imagine if a little bit of skullduggery occurred in the dark of night. Over time, you see, just very gradual. So here's a man's property that belongs to him, and rightfully so. Here's his block of land, you see. The vineyard that belongs to a man by inheritance. And then what happens is that overnight, people start to move the boundary stones, so that in fact, we have everything moving. Just a little bit. And so now we have a different shape. And then moved again. And so finally, we end up with a block of land that's been moved, so that now we have what looks like the same piece of land, but it's actually in a completely different place. And someone comes along and says, "That's not my piece of land." They say, "Oh, yes, it is." "No, that's not my piece of land. My piece of land was over there. I know that because the river always ran through the corner, and now the river's miles away from my piece of land. Has someone moved my boundary stones?" And you see, that could be something that could happen, is that those that were not driven by the spirit of the truth could, by moving the boundary stones just a little, just a little, just a little, just a little, until finally the boundary stones had been moved so far that the piece of property that the boundary stones were now bordered by is a completely different piece of dirt. Now come and have a look at Proverbs chapter 22, and 23, because clearly the possibility of that was envisaged. Proverbs 22 says, and I just want you to notice the context of the phrase here. Verse 22, "Rob not the poor because he is poor, neither oppress the afflicted in the gate, for Yahweh will plead their cause and spoil the soul of those that spoiled them." Verse 28, "Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set." So, do you see the context of verse 28? It's in the context of robbing the poor, verse 22, and oppressing the afflicted in the gate. So you see, in other words, there are those who are less able to defend their position, less able to defend their boundaries. And in the context of not robbing the poor or oppressing the afflicted, it says you are not to remove the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set, and to be reminded that Yahweh, verse 23, pleads the cause of those who are unable to look after themselves. Now see the next chapter, Proverbs 23 and verse 10. "Remove not the old landmark, and enter not into the fields of the fatherless. For their Redeemer is mighty. He shall plead their cause with thee." See how that's the same as chapter 22. "Don't enter into the field of the fatherless," verse 10. "Don't oppress the poor and the afflicted," chapter 22, verse 22. Why? "Because their Redeemer is mighty. He shall plead their cause," verse 11, which is the same as chapter 22, verse 23. "Yahweh shall plead their cause and spoil those that spoil them." And lastly, "Remove not the ancient landmark which thy fathers have set." So I think that there's the twofold warning of Proverbs here in the context of encroaching on the land of those not able to defend their position, perhaps the widows or the fatherless. And some powerful landowner would come along and move the border stones, move the border stones, move the border stones, and gradually, relentlessly encroach on the land that rightfully belonged to someone else, until in the end, that piece of land was no longer recognizable. Now, that's all quite simple, isn't it? It's quite a simple story, really. Remove not the ancient landmark. But the question is, and this is what today's all about, is, so what are the ancient landmarks of the truth? What are the boundary stones of worship? Yes, that could be right. In other words, what are the boundary stones that mark out the boundaries of our doctrine, of our worship, of our fellowship, of our preaching, of our music, of our separation from the world? There's boundary stones for the truth in all sorts of different areas. The question is, do we know what the boundary stones are? Do we know where the borders lie? And you see, the challenge that we have in our generation of the truth, and perhaps it's no different to any other generation, but in a way I think it is, the challenge that we have to our generation is that there are those within our community that are absolutely intent on moving the boundary stones on everything they can think of. In every subject in the community today of the Christadelphian Brotherhood, there's someone busy moving boundary stones, changing the borders of what we once believed and what we once stood for. Now the question is, do we know what those borders are? Because if we don't, we'll wake up one day and find the truth is in a completely different field to where once it stood. And unless we're aware of that, unless we can see what's going on, the nature and the form and finally, the substance of the truth can be absolutely changed. And suddenly you think, someone's moved the boundary stones here. Where were they once and where have they gone? And isn't it incumbent upon us to know where the stones should be so that we can make sure that they aren't being moved and that we are guarding the inheritance of our fathers and the ancient landmarks which our ancestors set? Now, I'm not talking about traditions here. I'm not talking about rules. I'm talking about principles. What are the border stones of principles for which there should be no movement whatsoever? We've got to live the truth, you know, in the context of the life and the circumstances that we find ourselves in. The culture in which we live our truth now is vastly different to that of Abraham or David or Paul. But the divine principles that work in our lives are identical to Paul, identical to Hezekiah, identical to David. So the question is, how do those boundary stones work and where do they sit in life today and are they being moved? You see, I think that part of our responsibility in the community is to know where the stones ought to lie and to make sure that they're being kept where they should be, so that the boundary lines of what's right and good and honourable and true in God's eyes stays absolutely on course and absolutely online. And every generation's got to find this out and figure it out, because if you don't figure it out in your generation, someone will move the stones, and they already are. So, that's the end of the session, believe it or not. Wasn't that quick? But the idea is that it sets, I think, the spirit of what the rest of today is all about, guarding the heritage of the truth. And if we can just get to grips with some of those vital things, which are a heritage that we have a responsibility to guard, this is the spiritual background as to why it is so important that we should do that. Remove, not the ancient landmark.